Party as an example, people recognize that in the great majority of circumstances, they are likely to be steered to a good choice if that choice fits with the views of experts on the topic. This recognition allows them a valuable decision-making shortcut. When they encounter the presence of solid authoritative data, they can cease further deliberation and follow the lead of authorities in the matter. Therefore, if a message points to authority-based evidence, the odds of persuasive success will jump. In recognition of the mounting behavioral science evidence for persuasion, though, I'd like to extend my earlier contention. Let's stay with the principle of authority to illustrate the expanded point. Communicators stand to be more effective by highlighting the idea of authority not just inside their message, but inside the moment before their message. In this persuasive way, audiences will become sensitized to, and thus readied for, the coming authoritative evidence in the message, making them more likely to pay attention to it, assign it importance, and consequently, be influenced by it. The roads oft taken. If it is indeed the case that directing attention, both before and during a message, to the concepts of reciprocation, liking, social proof, authority, scarcity, and consistency can influence recipients toward assent, it makes sense for us to review and update the information on how each concept operates. Accordingly, this chapter is not designed to focus primarily on the process of persuasion. Instead, we take a step back and explore the specifics of why these six concepts possess such sweeping psychological force. Reciprocation. People say yes to those they owe. Not always, of course. Nothing in human social interaction works like that. But often enough that behavioral scientists have labeled this tendency the rule for reciprocation. It states that those who have given benefits to us are entitled to benefits from us in return. So valuable is it to the functional health of societies that all human cultures teach the rule from childhood and assign socially punishing names: freeloader, user, taker, parasite, to those who don't give back after receiving. As a result, children respond to the rule before they are 2 years old. By the time they are adults, its persuasive power influences all aspects of their lives, including their buying patterns. In one study, shoppers at a candy store became 42% more likely to make a purchase if they'd received a gift piece of chocolate upon entry. According to sales figures from the retail giant Costco, other types of products, beer, cheese, frozen pizza, lipstick, get big lifts from free samples, almost all accounted for by the shoppers who accept the free offer. Much more worrisome is the impact of the rule on the voting actions of legislators. In the United States, companies making sizable campaign contributions to lawmakers who sit on tax policy-making committees see significant reductions in their tax rates. The legislators will deny any quid pro quo, but the companies know better, and so should we. Requesters who hope to commission the persuasive force of the rule for reciprocation have to do something that appears daring. They have to take a chance and give first. They must begin an interaction by providing initial gifts, favors, advantages, or concessions without a formal guarantee of compensation. But because the tendency to reciprocate is so embedded in most people, the strategy frequently works better than the traditional approach to commercial exchange, in which a requester offers benefits only after an action has been taken, a contract signed, a purchase made, a task performed. Dutch residents who received an advance letter asking if they would take part in a long survey were much more likely to agree if the proposed payment was sent to them before they decided to participate. The money accompanied the letter. Then if it was to be paid, as is normally the case, after they had participated. Similarly, hotel guests in the United States encountered a card in their rooms asking them to reuse their towels. They read in addition either that the hotel had already made a financial contribution to an environmental protection organization in the name of its guests, or that it would make such a contribution after guests did reuse their towels. The before the act donation proved 47% more effective than the after the act one. Still, supplying resources up front without the traditional guarantee of agreed upon compensation can be risky. Returns might not be forthcoming at adequate levels or at all, because certain recipients might resent being given something they didn't invite, while others might not judge what they got as beneficial to them. Others, the freeloaders among us, might not feel compelled by the rule. It makes sense to inquire, then, if there are specific features of an initial gift or favor that increase significantly the chance that it will be returned at high levels of recompense. There are three main features of this sort. In order to optimize the return, what we give first should be experienced as meaningful, unexpected, and customized. Meaningful and unexpected. The first two of these optimizing features have been shown to affect the size of tips that food servers receive. Some diners in a New Jersey restaurant were offered a piece of chocolate at the end of their meals, one per person, from a basket carried to the table by the waitress. Her tips went up 3.3% compared with those from guests who weren't offered chocolate. However, when other diners were invited to take two chocolates from the basket, the waitress's tips rose by 14.1%. What could account for the dramatic difference? For one, the second chocolate represented a meaningful increase in the size of the gift, a doubling. Plainly, meaningful is not the same as expensive, as the second chocolate cost only pennies. Providing a costly gift can often be meaningful, but costliness isn't necessary. Of course, the receipt of two chocolates was not only twice that of one chocolate, but also more unexpected. The clear-cut impact of a gift's unexpectedness became evident when the waitress tried yet a third technique. After offering guests one chocolate from her basket and turning to walk away, she unexpectedly returned to the table and offered a second chocolate to each diner. As a result, her average tip improved by 21.3%. There's a lesson in these multiple findings that goes well beyond informing restaurant servers of how to enrich their gratuities. Requesters of various sorts can elevate the likelihood that they will receive high levels of benefit from others if they first deliver benefits viewed by the others as meaningful and unexpected. But besides these features, there's a third element in the reciprocity optimizing triumvirate that, in my opinion, is more influential than the other two combined. Customized. When a first favor is customized to the needs, preferences, or current circumstances of the recipient, it gains leverage. Consider as evidence what happened in a fast food restaurant where visitors were greeted as they entered and given one of two equally priced gifts. If the gift was not food-related, a keychain, the amount they then spent increased by 12% compared with visitors who were greeted without being given a gift. But if the gift was food-related, a cup of yogurt, their increased outlay climbed to 24%. From a purely economic perspective, this finding is puzzling. Giving restaurant visitors free food before they order should make them likely to purchase less because they won't need to spend as much on a meal. Although the obtained, reverse outcome doesn't make good logical sense, it makes good psychological sense. Visitors went to the restaurant because they were hungry. An upfront gift of food activated not only the rule for reciprocation, but a more muscular version, which states that people should feel especially obligated to reciprocate a gift designed to meet their particular needs. If a gift, favor, or service incorporates all three features of meaningfulness, unexpectedness, and customization, it can become a formidable source of change. But might we be asking too much to expect it to make a difference in the struggle against hardcore terrorists? Perhaps not, for a pair of reasons. First, the rule for reciprocation is a cultural universal taught in all societies, including those from which terrorists spring. Second, accounts from within that struggle shed light on the singular power of favors that combine the three optimizing features. Take the case of Abu Jandal, Osama bin Laden's former chief bodyguard, who, following his capture, was questioned in a Yemeni prison in the days after 9/11. Attempts to get him to reveal information about al-Qaeda's leadership structure appeared hopeless, as his responses consisted only of screeds against the ways of the West. But when interrogators noticed that he never ate the cookies he was served with food and learned that the man was diabetic, they did something for him that was meaningful, unexpected, and customized. At the next interrogation session, they brought him sugar-free cookies to eat with tea. According to one of the interrogators, that was a key turning point. We had shown him respect, and we had done this nice thing for him, so he started talking to us instead of giving us lectures. In subsequent sessions, Jandal provided extensive data on al-Qaeda operations, as well as the names of seven of the 9/11 hijackers. But as any veteran of the battles with terrorism knows, sometimes the way to win those battles requires winning allies to the cause. U.S. intelligence officers in Afghanistan frequently visited rural territories to gain the assistance of tribal chiefs against the Taliban. These interactions were challenging because the leaders were often unwilling to help, owing to a dislike of Westerners, a fear of Taliban retribution, or both. On one such visit, a Central Intelligence Agency, CIA, operative noted a patriarch's exhaustion from the duties of heading his tribe and his immediate family, which included four younger wives. On the following visit, the CIA man came prepared with a fully optimized gift, four Viagra tablets, one per wife. The potency of this meaningful, unexpected, customized favor became manifest during the CIA agent's next trip, when the beaming leader responded with a wealth of information about Taliban movements and supply routes. Liking. Back when I was infiltrating the training programs of various sales organizations, I heard an assertion made repeatedly with great confidence. The number one rule for salespeople is to get your customer to like you. That was the case, we trainees were assured, because people say yes to those they like, something that was so undeniable that it never seemed interesting to me. What did interest me, though, was what we were told to do to arrange for customers to like us. Being friendly, attractive, and humorous were mentioned frequently in this regard. Accordingly, we were often given smiling lessons, grooming tips, and jokes to tell. But by far, two specific ways to create positive feelings got the most attention. We were instructed to highlight similarities and provide compliments. There's good reason why these two practices would be emphasized. Each increases liking and assent. Similarities. We like those who are like us. It's a tendency that's part of the human experience almost from the start. Infants smile more at adults whose facial expressions match their own, and the affinity can be activated by seemingly trivial similarities that might nonetheless generate big effects. parallels in language style, the types of words and verbal expressions conversation partners use, increase romantic attraction, relationship stability, and somewhat amazingly, the likelihood that a hostage negotiation will end peacefully. What's more, this influence occurs even though the overlap of styles typically goes unnoticed by the conversation partners. In addition, the consequences of the basic tendency are visible within helping decisions. People are massively more willing to help an emergency victim if they share a nationality or even a favorite sports team. The tendency also operates in educational settings. The factor that plays the largest role in the success of youth mentoring programs is the initial similarity of interests between student and mentor. But it is in the business arena where the impact on assent seems most direct. Waitresses coached to mimic the verbal style of customers doubled their tips. Negotiators coached to do the same with their opponents got significantly better final outcomes. Salespeople who mimicked the language styles and nonverbal behaviors, gestures, postures of customers sold more of the electronic equipment they recommended. Compliments. "I can live for 2 months," confessed Mark Twain, "on a good compliment." It's an apt metaphor, as compliments nourish and sustain us emotionally. They also cause us to like and benefit those who provide them. And this is true whether the praise is for our appearance, taste, personality, work habits, or intelligence. In the first of these categories, consider what happened in one hair salon when stylists complimented customers by saying, "Any hairstyle would look good on you." Their tips rose by 37%. Indeed, we seem so charmed by flattery that it can work on us even when it appears to have an ulterior motive. Chinese college students who received a pre-printed flyer from a clothing store saying, "We're contacting you because you're fashionable and stylish," developed positive attitudes toward the store and were more likely to want to shop there. Other researchers found that individuals who worked on a computer task and received flattering task-related feedback from the computer developed more favorable feelings toward the machine, even though they were told that the feedback had been pre-programmed and did not reflect their actual task performance at all. Nonetheless, they became prouder of their performances after receiving this hollow form of praise. The real number one rule for salespeople. I am hesitant to disagree with knowledgeable professionals that the number one rule for salespeople is to get your customer to like you, and that similarities and compliments are the best routes to that end. But I've seen research that makes me want to rethink their claims for why these statements are true. The account I heard in traditional sales training sessions always went as follows. Similarities and compliments cause people to like you, and once they come to recognize that they like you, they'll want to do business with you. Although this kind of persuasive process no doubt operates to some degree, I am convinced that a more influential persuasive mechanism is at work. Similarities and compliments cause people to feel that you like them, and once they come to recognize that you like them, they'll want to do business with you. That's because people trust that those who like them will try to steer them correctly. So by my lights, the number one rule for salespeople is to show customers that you genuinely like them. There's a wise adage that fits this logic well. People don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. Social proof. In John Lennon's song, Imagine, he proposes a world without hunger, greed, possessions, or countries, one characterized by universal brotherhood, peace, and unity. It's a world different from today's and indeed any other days in the long track of human history. While conceding that his vision seems that of a dreamer, He tries to convince listeners to accept it with a single follow-on fact. But I'm not the only one. Lenin's trust in this lone argument is a testament to the projected power of the principle of social proof. The principle asserts that people think it is appropriate for them to believe, feel, or do something to the extent that others, especially comparable others, are believing, feeling, or doing it. Two components of that perceived appropriateness, validity and feasibility, can drive change. Validity. After receiving information that multiple comparable others have responded in a particular way, that response seems more valid, more right to us, both morally and practically. As regards the first of these dimensions, when we see evidence of the increased frequency of an action, it elevates our judgments of the act's moral correctness. In one study, after learning that the majority of their peers supported the military's use of torture to gain information, 80% of group members found the practice more acceptable and demonstrated greater support for it in their public pronouncements and, more revealingly, their private opinions. Fortunately, besides increasing the acceptability of what might be undesirable, the responses of others can do the same for desirable behavior. Working professionals who were told that the great majority of people try to overcome their stereotypes became more resistant to stereotypes of women in their own work-related conduct. In addition to clarifying what's right morally, social proof reduces uncertainty about what's right pragmatically. Not every time, but the crowd is usually correct about the wisdom of actions, making the popularity of an activity a stand-in for its soundness. As a result, we typically follow the lead of those around us who are like us. The upshots can be remarkable, creating simple, almost costless solutions to traditional influence challenges. Restaurant managers can increase the demand for particular dishes on their menus without the expense of upgrading the recipes with more costly ingredients, the kitchen staff with new personnel, or the menu with flowery descriptions of the selected items. They have only to label the items as most popular dishes. When this entirely honest yet rarely employed tactic was tried in a set of restaurants in Beijing, China, each dish became 13% to 20% more popular. Restaurateurs aren't the only ones who can use social proof to affect food choices. Instead of bearing the cost of assembling and communicating extensive nutritional information regarding the health benefits of eating fruit, a school can lift its students' fruit intake by stating, contrary to what students think, that the majority of their schoolmates do try to eat fruit to be healthy. This kind of information increased the fruit consumption of Dutch high schoolers by 35%. Even though, in classic adolescent fashion, they claimed no intention to change. Many governments expend significant resources regulating, monitoring, and sanctioning companies that pollute our air and water. These expenditures often appear wasted on some of the offenders, who either flout the regulations altogether or are willing to pay fines that are smaller than the costs of compliance. But certain nations have developed cost-effective programs that work by firing up the non-polluting engine of social proof. They initially rate the environmental performance of polluting firms within an industry and then publicize the ratings, so that all companies in that industry can see where they stand relative to their peers. The overall improvements have been dramatic, upward of 30%, almost all of which have come from changes made by the relatively heavy polluters, who recognized how poorly they'd been doing compared with their contemporaries. Feasibility. With a set of estimable colleagues leading the way, I once did a study to see what we could best say to get people to conserve household energy. We delivered one of four messages to their homes, once a week for a month, asking them to reduce their energy consumption. Three of the messages contained a frequently employed reason for conserving energy. The environment will benefit. Or it's the socially responsible thing to do. Or it will save you significant money on your next power bill. The fourth message played the social proof card, stating, honestly, that most of your fellow community residents do try to conserve energy at home. At the end of the month, we recorded how much energy was used and learned that the social proof-based message had generated 3.5 times as much energy savings as any of the other messages. The size of the difference surprised almost everyone associated with the study, me for one, but also my fellow researchers, and even a sample of other homeowners. The homeowners, in fact, expected that the social proof message would be least effective. When I report on this research to utility company officials, they frequently don't trust it because of an entrenched belief that the strongest motivator of human action is economic self-interest. They say something like, "Come on, how are we supposed to believe that telling people their neighbors are conserving is three times more effective than telling them they can cut their power bills significantly?" Although there are various possible responses to this legitimate question, there's one that's nearly always proven persuasive for me. It involves the second reason, besides validity, that social proof information works so well: feasibility. If I inform homeowners that by saving energy, they could also save a lot of money, it doesn't mean that they would be able to make it happen. After all, I could reduce my next power bill to zero if I turned off all the electricity in my house and curled up on the floor in the dark for a month. But that's not something I'd reasonably do. A great strength of social proof information is that it destroys the problem of uncertain achievability. If people learn that many others like them are conserving energy, there is little doubt as to its feasibility. It comes to seem realistic and therefore implementable. Authority. For most people, the way to make a message persuasive is to get its content right, to ensure that the communication possesses strong evidence, sound reasoning, good examples, and clear relevance. Although this view, the merit is the message, is certainly correct to an extent, some scholars have argued that other parts of the process can be just as important. The most famous of these contentions is embodied in the assertion of the communication theorist Marshall McLuhan that the medium is the message. The idea that the channel through which information is sent is a form of consequential messaging itself, which affects how recipients experience content. In addition, persuasion scientists have pointed to compelling support for yet a third claim: the messenger is the message. Of the many types of messengers, positive, serious, humorous, emphatic, modest, critical, there is one that deserves special attention because of its deep and broad impact on audiences: the authoritative communicator. When a legitimate expert on a topic speaks, people are usually persuaded. Indeed, sometimes information becomes persuasive only because an authority is its source. This is especially true when the recipient is uncertain of what to do. Take as evidence the results of a study in which individuals had to make a series of difficult economic decisions while hooked up to brain scanning equipment. When they made choices on their own, related activity jumped in the areas of the brain associated with evaluating options. But when they received expert advice on any of these decisions from a distinguished university economist, they not only followed that advice, they did so without thinking about the inherent merits of the options. Related activity in the evaluating sectors of their brains flatlined. Tellingly, not all brain regions were affected in this way. the sectors associated with understanding another's intentions were activated by the expert's advice. The messenger had become the focal message. As should be plain from this illustration, the kind of authority we are concerned with here is not necessarily someone who is in authority, someone who has hierarchical status and can thereby command assent by way of recognized power, but someone who is an authority and can thereby induce assent by way of recognized expertise. Moreover, within this latter category, there is a type, the credible authority, who is particularly productive. A credible authority possesses the combination of two highly persuasive qualities, expertise and trustworthiness. We've already considered the effects of the first. Let's concentrate on the second. Trustworthiness. If there is one quality we most want to see in those we interact with, it is trustworthiness. And this is the case compared with other highly rated traits, such as attractiveness, intelligence, cooperativeness, compassion, and emotional stability. In a persuasion-focused interaction, we want to trust that a communicator is presenting information in an honest and impartial fashion. That is, attempting to depict reality accurately rather than to serve self-interest. Over the years, I've attended a lot of programs designed to teach influence skills. Almost to a one, they've stressed that being perceived as trustworthy is an effective way to increase one's influence and that it takes time for that perception to develop. Although the first of these points remains confirmed, a growing body of research indicates that there is a noteworthy exception to the second. It turns out to be possible to acquire instant trustworthiness by employing a clever strategy. Rather than succumbing to the tendency to describe all of the most favorable features of an offer or idea up front, and reserving mention of any drawbacks until the end of the presentation, or never, a communicator who references a weakness early on is immediately seen as more honest. The advantage of this sequence is that, with perceived truthfulness already in place, when the major strengths of the case are advanced, the audience is more likely to believe them. After all, they've been conveyed by a trustworthy source, one whose honesty has been established persuasively by a willingness to point not just to positive aspects, but also to negative ones. The effectiveness of this approach has been documented, one, in legal settings, where a trial attorney who admits to a weakness before the rival attorney points it out is viewed as more credible and wins more often. Two, in political campaigns, where a candidate who begins with something positive to say about an opponent gains trustworthiness and voting intentions. And three, in advertising messages, where merchandisers who acknowledge a drawback before highlighting strengths often see large increases in sales. The tactic can be particularly successful when the audience is already aware of the weakness. Thus, when a communicator mentions it, little additional damage is done, as no new information is added, except, crucially, that the communicator is an honest individual. Another enhancement occurs when the speaker uses a transitional word, such as however, or but, or yet, that channels the listener's attention away from the weakness and onto a countervailing strength. A job candidate might say, "I am not experienced in this field, but I am a very fast learner." An information systems salesperson might state, "Our setup costs are not the lowest. However, you'll recoup them quickly due to our superior efficiencies." Elizabeth I of England employed both of these enhancements to optimize the impact of the two most celebrated speeches of her reign. The first occurred at Tilbury in 1588, when, while addressing her troops, massed against an expected sea invasion from Spain, she dispelled the soldiers' concern that as a woman she was not up to the rigors of battle. "I know I have the body of a weak and feeble woman, but I have the heart of a king and a king of England, too." It is reported that so long and loud were the cheers after this pronouncement that officers had to ride among the men, ordering them to restrain themselves so that the queen could continue. 13 years later, perhaps recalling the success of this rhetorical device, she used it again in her final formal remarks to Parliament members, many of whom mistrusted her. "Near the completion of those remarks," she proclaimed, "and though you have had, and may have, many mightier and wiser princes sitting in this seat, yet you have never had, nor shall have, any that will love you better." According to British historian Richard Cavendish, audience members left the hall transfigured, many of them in tears, and on that very day labeled her oration the Queen's Golden Speech, a label that has endured ever since. Notice that Elizabeth's bridging terms, but and yet, took listeners from perceived weaknesses to counteracting strengths. That their leader possessed the heart of a king, once accepted, filled the troops with the confidence they lacked and needed before battle. Similarly, that she loved her subjects transcendently, once accepted, disarmed even her wary opponents in Parliament. This feature of the Queen's persuasive assertions fits with scientific research showing that the weakness before strength tactic works best when the strength doesn't just add something positive to the list of pros and cons, but instead challenges the relevance of the weakness. For instance, Elizabeth didn't seek to embolden the troops at Tilbury by saying there is no one that will love you better, as her fighters had to be assured of a stout-hearted commander, not a soft-hearted one. She understood that to maximize its effect, an initially deployed weakness should not only be selected to pre-establish the trustworthiness of one's later claims, but also it should also be selected to be undercut by those claims. Her weak and feeble woman's body became inconsequential for battlefield leadership if, in the minds of her men, it carried the heart of a king and a king of England, too. Scarcity. We want more of what we can have less of. For instance, when access to a desired item is restricted in some way, people have been known to go a little crazy for it. After the chain of pastry shops, Crumbs, announced in 2014 that it would be closing all of its locations, its signature cupcakes, which had been priced at around $4, began commanding up to $250 apiece online. The effect isn't limited to cupcakes. On the morning of the retail release of the latest iPhone, my local TV news channel sent a reporter to interview individuals who had been waiting all night to secure one. A woman who was 23rd in line disclosed something that fits this well-established point, but it still astounded me. She had started her wait as 25th in line, but had struck up a conversation during the night with number 23, a woman who admired her $2,800 Louis Vuitton shoulder bag. Seizing her opportunity, the first woman proposed and concluded a trade. "My bag for your spot in line." At the end of the woman's self-satisfied account, the understandably surprised interviewer stammered, "But why?" and got a telling answer. "Because," the new number 23 replied, "I heard that this store didn't have a big supply, and I didn't want to risk losing the chance to get one." Although there are several reasons that scarcity drives desire, our aversion to losing something of value is a key factor. After all, loss is the ultimate form of scarcity, rendering the valued item or opportunity unavailable. At a financial services conference, I heard the CEO of a large brokerage firm make the point about the motivating power of loss by describing a lesson his mentor once taught him. If you wake a multimillionaire client at 5 a.m. and say, "If you act now, you will gain $20,000," he'll scream at you and slam down the phone. But if you say, "If you don't act now, you will lose $20,000, he'll thank you. But the scarcity of an item does more than raise the possibility of loss. It also raises the judged value of that item. When automobile manufacturers limit production of a new model, its value goes up among potential buyers. Other restrictions in other settings generate similar results. At one large grocery chain, brand promotions that included a purchase limit, only X per customer, more than doubled sales for 7 different types of products, compared with promotions for the same products that didn't include a purchase limit. Follow-up studies showed why. In the consumer's mind, any constraint on access increased the worth of what was being offered. Consistency. Normally, we want to be and to be seen as consistent with our existing commitments, such as the previous statements we've made, stands we've taken, and actions we've performed. Therefore, communicators who can get us to take a persuasive step, even a small one, in the direction of a particular idea or entity will increase our willingness to take a much larger, congruent step when asked. The desire for consistency will prompt it. This powerful pull toward personal alignment is used in a wide range of influence settings. Psychologists warn us that sexual infidelity within romantic relationships is a source of great conflict, often leading to anger, pain, and termination of the relationship. Fortunately, they've also located a persuasive activity that can help prevent the occurrence of this toxic sequence. Prayer. Not prayer in general, though, but a particular kind. If one romantic partner agrees to pray for the other's well-being every day for an extended period of time, he or she becomes less likely to be unfaithful while doing so. After all, such behavior would be inconsistent with the daily actively made commitment to the partner's welfare. Influence practitioners have frequently found the human tendency for consistency with one's prior, persuasive words and deeds to be of service. Automobile insurance companies can reduce policyholders' misreporting of odometer readings by putting an honesty pledge at the beginning of the reporting form rather than at the end. Political parties can increase the chance that supporters will vote in the next election by having arranged for them, through various get-out-the-vote activities, to vote in the previous one. Brands can deepen the loyalty of customers by getting them to recommend the brand to a friend. Organizations can raise the probability that an individual will appear at a meeting or event by switching from saying at the end of a reminder phone call, "We'll mark you on the list as coming then, thank you," to "We'll mark you on the list as coming then, okay?" Pause for confirmation. Thank you. One blood services organization that made this tiny commitment-inducing wording change increased the participation of likely donors in a blood drive from 70% to 82.4%. Sometimes practitioners can leverage the force of the consistency principle without installing a new commitment at all. Sometimes all that's necessary is to remind others of a commitment they've made that fits with the practitioner's goals. Consider how the legal team arguing to the U.S. Supreme Court for marriage equality in 2013 structured a months-long national PR campaign with one man as its primary target, Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy. Public opinion had already moved in favor of same-sex marriage. Despite the operation's nationwide scope before the court hearings, the campaign most wanted to influence Kennedy for two reasons. First, he was widely considered to be the one to cast the deciding vote in both of the companion cases the court was considering on the issue. Second, he was a frequent fence-sitter on ideological matters. On the one hand, he was a traditionalist, holding that the law should not be interpreted in a way that drifted far from its original language. On the other hand, he believed the law to be a living thing, with meanings that evolved over time. This foot in each camp position made Kennedy a prime candidate for a communication approach designed not to change one of his contrasting points of view, but rather to connect only one of them to the issue of marriage equality. The media campaign provided just such an approach by employing a set of concepts and even wordings that Kennedy had used in prior court opinions. Human dignity, individual liberty, and personal freedoms/rights. As a consequence, wherever Kennedy went in the weeks and months before oral arguments in the cases, he would likely hear the relevant issues linked in the media campaign to that selected set of three of his stated views. The intent was to get him to perceive his prior pertinent legal stances as associated with the pro-marriage equality position. The intent was enacted much more explicitly once the hearings began. Legal team members repeatedly developed their in-court arguments from the same Kennedy-tied language and themes. Did this tactic contribute to the court's 5-4 rulings in favor of marriage equality? It is difficult to know for certain. But members of the legal team think so, and they point to an affirming piece of evidence. In his written opinions, Kennedy leaned heavily on the concepts of dignity, liberty, and freedoms/rights, all of which they had labored to prioritize within his marriage equality-related thinking both before and during the formal hearings. It is perhaps testament to the durability of properly evoked commitments that in another marriage equality case 2 years later, these same three concepts figured prominently once again in Justice Kennedy's majority opinion. What else can be said about the universal principles of influence? After presenting the six principles of social influence to a business-focused audience, it is not unusual for me to hear two questions. The first concerns the issue of optimal timing. Are different stages of a commercial relationship suited better to certain of the principles? Thanks to my colleague, Dr. Gregory Niedert, I have an answer, which is yes. Moreover, I have an explanation, which comes from what Dr. Niedert has developed as the core motives model of social influence. Of course, any would-be influencer wants to affect change in others, but according to the model, the stage of one's relationship with them affects which influence principles to best employ. At the first stage, the main goal involves cultivating a positive association, as people are more favorable to a communication if they are favorable to the communicator. Two principles of influence, reciprocity and liking, seem particularly appropriate to the task. Giving first, in a meaningful, unexpected, and customized fashion, highlighting genuine commonalities, and offering true compliments establish mutual rapport that facilitates all future dealings. At the second stage, reducing uncertainty becomes a priority. A positive relationship with a communicator doesn't ensure persuasive success. Before people are likely to change, they want to see any decision as wise. Under these circumstances, the principles of social proof and authority offer the best match. Pointing to evidence that a choice is well regarded by peers or experts significantly increases confidence in its wisdom. But even with a positive association cultivated and uncertainty reduced, a remaining step needs to be taken. At this third stage, motivating action is the main objective. That is, a well-liked friend might show me sufficient proof that experts recommend, and almost all my peers believe, that daily exercise is a good thing, but that might not be enough to get me to do it. The friend would do well to include in his appeal the principles of consistency and scarcity by reminding me of what I've said publicly in the past about the importance of my health and the unique enjoyments I would miss if I lost it. That's the message that would most likely get me up in the morning and off to the gym. The second question I am frequently asked about the principles is whether I've identified any new ones. Until recently, I'd always had to answer in the negative. But now I believe there is a seventh universal principle that I had missed. Not because some new cultural phenomenon or technological shift brought it to my attention, but because it was hiding beneath the surface of my data all along. I explain what it is and how I came to see it next. Chapter 11. Unity 1. Being Together. For years, as part of a university class lecture, I would describe a study showing that sending holiday greeting cards to complete strangers produced a surprisingly large number of greeting cards sent dutifully in return. In class, I'd attribute the finding to the operation of the principle of reciprocity, which obligates people to give back to those who first given to them, even, apparently, under wholly puzzling circumstances. I liked lecturing about that study because it illustrated the point I wanted to make about the power of the principle and, in the interests of improving my teacher's ratings, the students got a laugh from it. After one of those lectures, an older student, one who had returned to school after having raised a family, stopped and thanked me for solving a decade-long mystery in her home. She said that 10 years prior, her family had received a Christmas card from the Harrisons of Santa Barbara, California. But neither she nor her husband remembered knowing any Harrisons in Santa Barbara. She was sure there must have been a mistake and that the Harrisons misaddressed the envelope. Yet her family had received a holiday card from them. So, true to the principle of reciprocity, she sent one in return. "We're in the 10th year of exchanging cards with these people," she confessed, "and I still don't know who they are. But now at least I know why I sent them that first card." Several months later, she came to my office, declaring that she had to bring me up to date on the story. Her youngest son, Skip, was about to begin college at the University of California at Santa Barbara. But because of a repair problem, his dormitory room wasn't ready, and he needed a place to stay for a few days until the problem was fixed. Although the university offered him temporary housing in a motel, his mother didn't like that idea. Instead, she thought, "Who do we know in Santa Barbara?" "The Harrisons." So she called and was relieved to learn that they'd be happy to have Skip as a house guest. She left my office claiming to be more amazed than ever by the influence the principle of reciprocity had on human behavior. In this case, her own and the Harrisons. I was less convinced, though. Certainly I could see that my student's initial decision to send a card fit with the obligation to reciprocate. But the Harrisons' decision to let Skip stay with them didn't fit with that obligation at all. There was no outstanding debt to be repaid by the Harrisons when they'd agreed. Holiday cards and accompanying year-end letters had been exchanged equally. Thus, in terms of obligations, the two families were even. It seemed upon reflection that although the rule for reciprocation might have started the process, it was the 10-year resultant relationship between the families that compelled the Harrisons to open their home to an 18-year-old they'd never met. That realization made me appreciate the freestanding power of social connections to generate assent, separate from the other six principles of influence. Relationships not only intensify willingness to help, but also cause it. There's a lesson here. Our ability to create change in others is often and importantly grounded in shared personal relationships, which create a persuasive context for assent. It's a poor trade-off, then, for social influence when we allow present-day forces of separation, distancing societal changes, insulating modern technologies, to take a shared sense of human connection out of our exchanges. The relation gets removed, leaving just the ships passing at sea. Unity. What kind of existing or perceived relationships maximize the favorable treatment of fellow members? The answer requires a subtle but crucial distinction. The relationships that lead people to favor another most effectively are not those that allow them to say, "Oh, that person is like us." They are the ones that allow people to say, "Oh, that person is of us." For instance, I might have many more tastes and preferences in common with a colleague at work than with a sibling. But there is no question which of the two I would consider of me and which I would consider merely like me, and which, consequently, I would more likely help in a time of need. The experience of unity is not about simple similarities, although those can work too, but to a lesser degree via the liking principle. It's about shared identities. It's about the categories that individuals use to define themselves and their groups, such as race, ethnicity, nationality, and family, as well as political and religious affiliations. A key characteristic of these categories is that their members tend to feel at one with, merged with, the others. They are the categories in which the conduct of one member influences the self-esteem of other members. Put simply, we is the shared me. The evidence for overlapping self and other identities within we-based groups is varied and impressive. People often fail to distinguish correctly between themselves and in-group members, unduly assigning their own characteristics to those others, repeatedly failing to recall which personal traits they had rated previously for in-group members or for themselves, and taking significantly longer to identify traits that differentiated in-group members from themselves, all of which reflects a confusion of self and other. Neuroscientists have offered an explanation for the confusion. Mental representations of the concepts of self and of close others emerge from the same brain circuitry. Activating either of those concepts can lead to neuronal cross-excitation of the other concept and the consequent blurring of identities. Long before the neuroscientific evidence was available, social scientists were measuring the feeling of self-other overlap and identifying what brought it about. In the process, they uncovered two categories of factors that led to a sense of we-ness, those involving particular ways of being together and particular ways of acting together. Each deserves our examination, the first in the present chapter. Being together. Kinship. From a genetic point of view, being in the same family, the same bloodline, is the ultimate form of self-other unity. Indeed, the widely accepted concept of inclusive fitness within evolutionary biology undermines specifically the distinction between self and related others, asserting that individuals do not so much attempt to ensure their own survival as the survival of copies of their genes. The crucial implication is that the self, in self-interest, can lie outside of one's body and inside the skin of another, who shares a goodly amount of genetic material. For this reason, people are particularly willing to help genetically close relatives, especially in survival-related decisions, such as whether to donate a kidney